stop drawing attention to shit I've done. Yes.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to The Call Sheet. I'm Keith Coogan, and you're listening live at SkidRowStudios.com, or you could have been subscribing to someone like iTunes and Stitcher and Smacker, and I don't know what they've invented these days, but Licker. Thanks for tuning in. Licker, I don't even know her. We have a special guest tonight. This is a gentleman who has been a friend for a long time, never had the opportunity to work with him, which is a shame because I get you, bro. We are talking to Scott Schwartz. Thank you.
You're very welcome. How you doing, brother?
I'm awesome, man. How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
You look fucking great.
Thank you. So do you.
Handsome man. My God. Well, thank you.
He needs
a new
pair of glasses, everybody.
No. These are good. Well, I'm going to drop into my radio voice and thank you for coming out.
You're more than welcome.
A week's notice and this man's on it. And you're a total pro. I've always loved your work. Very jealous of a particular film because I auditioned for Christmas Story.
Really?
Yeah. Will Wheaton's got a great post on auditioning for Christmas Story. And he calls us all out for being there. And it was Marina Del Rey. It was in, remember? It was like off of...
No, see, I auditioned in New York.
Oh, see, were you a New York kid?
Yeah.
See, I hated you guys because they would fly you out and stuff but put you up and all that other stuff. And you guys got great quotes. And we're like, how come these New Yorkers are coming taking all our work in LA?
See, but I didn't get that for Christmas Story. I when I did the toy, I came out for the screen test. But for Christmas Story, I had finished up a film called Kidco, small movie that I did for 20th. I got home on December 11th, and the 13th was a Monday, and Bob Clark called me in, basically like he called my agent like 10 o'clock in the morning, can you come in later? I went into the city, and there was really no audition. There was no paperwork. There was no sides. There was no dialogue. It was just he and I sitting in a room, blah, blah, blah. We were BSing for a little bit. Then he brought in a couple of girls that he wanted to try and match me up with to see for sisters or whatever. Not for sisters, for just other people, whatever it was. And then we went out to lunch. And I came back and he said, listen, I just want to thank you. I appreciate your time and coming. And no problem. He bought lunch. It was great.
No, were there sides? Were you going to go read? Or was
nothing.
Just, you're going to go meet?
I was just going to go meet. He had seen the toy already. It had come out in the movie theater. So he knew I could do the job. And we got about halfway home. And by the time we got home, my agent called and said, oh, you got the movie.
That's great.
You know, Bob just wanted to see my personality.
I finally read online the secret of how they stuck such tongue to such pole.
Oh, yes.
And I never knew.
Really?
I read it 3 days ago. I swear to God, the illusion was so real.
Oh, my God. I can't believe you weren't one of the 4 million people who bought the 25th anniversary Christmas Story so that they could put more stuff and make more money off of us, you know, with the buried the...
No, but I would watch it 3 or 4 times at least on a Christmas Story day on Turner.
That's what they should call it now. Just, you know, forget Christmas Eve. Just call it the Christmas Story Day, and then the next day is Christmas.
And it was great. It would end, and it would start again. And of course, and it was like, yeah, just keep watching it.
You just keep watching it.
Because it's great. It's
I flip in and out now. I can't watch the whole thing. I just can't do it because I've seen it too many times. So it's like I know the timing of certain scenes that I want to watch, and that's when I turn it on. I cheat.
I cheat, too. I'm like, oh, God, Christina Applegate and Josh Charles under the pier. Fucking fast forward this.
See, but we have to be jealous of somebody is okay. It's like, I'm jealous of you. I mean, you know, you got to work with Christina. I never got to work with Christina, although we're friends. You got to work, and it's like, okay, and great cast and all of that, and a fun movie. But I didn't get to work with those people. But I mean, it's okay.
But yeah,
it's
but
not
you're
really
a part
jealousy.
Of Bob Clark world, which for a filmite like me is a pretty special little group.
It is. It's a fun group.
He's got a universe that is unique to not only film and tone, but also how movies get made and how they get financed, how they get birthed from the canal.
Even if blackmail is involved, basically, because that's how Christmas Story got made. Christmas Story was made. He blackmailed MGM into doing it. They didn't want to do it. And he had done Porky's and made $110 million on a $2 million budget. And they wanted to do Porky's too. And he went, absolutely, I'll do it for you right after I do Christmas Story.
Good for him.
And they were like, what's that? Well, it's this film I want to do. Well, no, do Porky's. And then he said, no, I'll do this one first.
No, wait, Porky's wasn't his first, though, was it? Or was it just the first big hit for
Monster hit for him.
Okay, first big monster. Yeah. So really the second picture is always a big thing for a director after a big, now you're on the radar.
Yeah.
And everyone's watching The Money and everyone's watching how it plays.
Even watching The Money, MGM was horrible. He gave them a budget of $5 million. They said, no, we'll give you $4 million. He said, no, the budget is $5 million. They said, no, we'll give you $4 million. He said, I'll tell you what, I'll put up $1 million of my own. You give me a piece of the film. They laughed at him and said, sure. There you go.
Ooh.
Yeah.
They gave him a piece of the film. And it's, you know, I think younger audiences today that have become fans of the film, because they have to. It's timeless because it
doesn't really affect any one particular generation. It's every generation. You got every 70-year-old who remembers that favorite Christmas they had. And you got every 9-year-old who's still living it. So everybody in the middle is a part of it.
Great stuff. And Notorious, you got the best scene, most memorable bit.
I've told the story several times. I get Christmas Story. They tell me I got the film. Bob sends me the script, not telling me what role I'm playing. So I've done The Toy. I'm co-starring with Pryor and Gleason. Okay, fine. I'm the star kid. Go,
great.
Okay, fine.
You're getting a Red Ryder.
So
awesome.
Getting a Red Ryder. So I sit down for the first three weeks with it, and I memorize the whole script. I memorize Ralphie. We get to Toronto. We have the table reading. And Bob walks around the room and says, okay, Peter, you're going to play Ralphie, and RD, you're going to play Schwartz, and Scotty, you're playing Flick, and Zach, you're playing, you know, Scott Farkas. And I'm sitting there going, Flick? No, it can't be right. That's, you know, whatever. I'm looking at my father. He's looking at me, and I start flipping through the script. I'm like, he's got 15 lines. They got me here for 6 weeks at $6,500 a week to do 16 lines. I turned around. I wrote on a piece of paper. I said, Dad, it's called a vacation.
Yeah, so, those are nice. They used to do that in the day. They would bring the whole cast, a whole ensemble. Everyone spends the whole time on location.
Yeah. I was working one day a week. It was hysterical. And after the read-through, I said, I pulled Bob aside, and my dad pulled Bob aside, and I said, Bob, are you sure about this? I said, you know, I did this, and I'm dead. He says, no, you're perfect for Flick. You're going to be great. It's not the size of the role, but what you make out of it.
Well, you made quite a bit out of it.
Exactly.
One of the things that I saw online, one of the responses I got when I announced that you would be a guest, talking to my friends, Kidco kept
fun
coming
movie.
Up.
Fun little movie. What do you want to know?
No.
Who it just, had crushes it, on, it, the fact I was trying to hump my older sister. What do you want to know? Come on.
Come on. That's gross. You can't do that. That's your
sister. In the movie. Which, of course, she wasn't my sister.
Now, what I wanted to ask you was kids earning a living and working in an adult world in the story. Did that resonate with you on the set? Your role as a money earner and all that good other good stuff.
It resonated me. That had nothing to do with my household. My mother worked at AT&T. My father had his own business. They didn't need the money that I brought in.
Good for them. Good, absolutely good.
But me, I was an entrepreneur already. I was a hustler already. There was a golf course down the street from my house, and I used to go through the woods and find golf balls and stick them in the egg crates, 50 cents a ball. It's 100 degrees in New Jersey out on the golf course. Hey, I got lemonade for you. It's 50 cents a glass. So here comes Kidco, and it happens, and I'm going, dude, I've done this stuff already. I want to do this stuff at home. This is great. This is going to be easy. I mean, the gambling stuff that they did in the gym room and all that, that was all made up crap. But, you know, it was easy. It was fun. Ron Maxwell, who directed it, was just no problem to work with. The dad was Charlie Hallahan, who did God knows how many films. Most people know him from The Thing, with Kurt Russell. Oh, yeah. He's the one with the head that comes off the table and draws the legs.
Everyone could see the drool on my face right now. I'm a Thing fan. I just saw the remake of The Thing, or the sequel, the prequel. Did you see the prequel to The Thing?
Yeah, man.
I just
take with the Kurt Russell one. It's fine.
Crap out of me, and it was good. It nodded up to the original. Sorry, big fan. Yeah. Had a drool there for a minute.
No. But the guy that played my dad was great. Charlie, he just, you know, there was a few things I asked him, pointers and stuff like that, and he was just terrific. We had a 10-week shooting schedule, and I don't think I've ever said this story publicly.
Okay.
This is one of those, I'm writing my book now, so I'm going over stuff, and we had a 10-week shooting schedule, but the schedule was supposed to end like December 22nd or 23rd, like right before Christmas. Mm-hmm. The Toy was opening up December 10th. So I figured Columbia is going to be sending me here and sending me there and PR. I have to be free. I'm 14 years old. We did the read. We were down in we shot it in Old Tucson in Arizona. And we get through the read through and I call for a meeting. I've done one movie. I call for a meeting.
Really?
Yeah.
It prompted by folks or anything?
No. This was me. I'm okay. This is what needs to be. So it's me.
I love
you, Scott. It's me, my dad. David Niven Jr., Frank Yablons, Ron Maxwell, the two producers, Frank Yablons, David Niven Jr., the director, Ron Maxwell, the first AD, Alan, whatever the hell, I can't think of his last name, and like one other person. And I take him into a side room and I said, listen, the shooting schedule is great, but it doesn't work for me. I've done one movie. It doesn't work for me. I go, we have to be done December 10th. It's a Friday. The Toy opens in the movie theaters. I have to be free to do PR and whatever. Within 30 seconds, I get thrown out of the room. Get out. They're like, get out. Goodbye. Go away. Just me. Not my father. Just me. Okay. They turned around and looked at my father and they said, what do we have here? What did we just do? You know, we just hired a kid who's telling us how we're going to shoot a movie and the time frame and whatever. And my father said, listen, 99% of the time, I'm one of the adults and I will support you. However, you don't know my kid. He's a monster. He's Godzilla. Just ride his coattails, jump on his back, and he will take you to the promised land. And if he says to you, we're going to be done December 10th, we're going to be done December 10th. They're like, they all laughed at him. They were all crazy. My dad's like, listen, whatever your shooting schedule is, book three more scenes. You'll get them done. And they did this. In the first 2 weeks of shooting, we were done with 3 weeks of shooting. By 6 weeks of shooting, we were at 8 weeks. At 10 weeks, we were done. We wrapped the movie December 10th, 1982, which is the day the Toy opened. The wrap party, the first half of it, they rented four rows at the local movie theater, and we went to see the night the Toy opened.
Yeah. And then the Toy opened. And you had, I know we're backing into it, but that does bring us to the Toy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not only... you know, a very, very heavy and very meaty work for you and great comedy. And you even told me some great stuff about working with Gleason and how he was, you know, improvising. And
he was the great one.
You know, he was the great one. But the thing about the Toy was it was also, I thought, one of Richard Pryor's greatest work. And you're only as good as the people that you work with. So you seem to have been giving something to him that he could work with. And I think it's some of Pryor's greatest work.
Richard was the kind of person that if you talk to him, you could have an instant rapport with him. And I talked to him from the day I met him, you know, before shooting. So we already had a rapport going in. That made it that much more comfortable. I mean, let's face it. It's a relationship movie. We understand it's the rich white guy buys the black guy. We understand that. But it's a relationship movie between all the pieces.
Yeah, but he did it for his son, who he loves, mm-hmm. and who helps make him change, too.
Right.
And Richard Pryor's got a great arc. and I remember I talked to you, and I had seen it before, and I'd also then watched it again after you with some perspective. Because I, like some other people online, were like, well, this is kind of racial here, and I can't believe this. I watched it and no, I mean, I think if you really are paying attention, the context is always very clear.
Yes. And I've heard the racial thing and I mean, times have changed. It's politically correct bullshit.
They sold the movie with the poster of him on strings.
Well, it's supposed to be a puppet.
But Richard Pryor is a great comedian, not necessarily known as a great black comedian. So that's another like aspect of it.
He transcends
you could ignore
it all,
part of it. Exactly.
Yeah, he transcends all
Thank
of it.
You
but
for,
I always say, give me you know, any African-American man or white male who works a regular job. And you tell him, you're going to babysit this kid for a week. We're going to pay you 10 grand. If that's slavery, sign me up. It's not. It's ridiculous. You know, so, I mean, that was kind of the undertone of it. Mm-hmm. But there's so much fun with the woman that plays Fancy Bates, Teresa Ganzel, and her and I had a blast. And, you know, it was a light set. There was the respect level of Mr. Gleason. You always had to be very respectful. It's Mr. Gleason. Mm. You know,
was the set different when he was there and then when he was not?
A little bit. Not too much, but a little bit.
What kind of vibe? Because Dick Donner, I've always auditioned for things and I never got anything Dick Donner directed. So what's the vibe on the set with him?
I don't know if I would consider him a true actor's director. Like he's more of like the Superman, the Lethal Weapon, that kind of the Omen, not heavy duty direction toward his actors. Ron Maxwell is heavily into giving his actors some direction. You know, Dick Donner, just kind of do what you want and I'll see if I like it or not. That's how he directed. You know, it made it very easy because Pryor gave me so much leeway that it was great because he and I played off terrific. We knew what we were doing before we got there. You know, which made it easy, made it fast, no problems. And Dick, I don't think Dick Donner gave me 10 bits of direction in 4 months.
Dick Donner is one of those people, think Superman, for making a masterwork.
Oh. Listen, if you watch Superman 2, the old version and the Dick Donner version, there is no comparison. I mean, Richard Donner's version is 100 times better and it's darker and it's more intense. You know, the second one, kind of bubbly and whatever, you know, and the thing with the, when Lois Lane finds out that he's Superman in the honeymoon suite in Toronto and all, yeah, whatever. And then, you know, with the putting his hand in the fire and the Dick Donner version, she takes out a gun and she's going to shoot him.
Oh, yeah, totally. You know? See, I remember seeing these much younger, but I didn't remember the distinction because, you know,
you have to watch
alternate versions.
Dick Donner version didn't exist until a couple, 2-3 years ago when he brought it out on DVD. They did the Richard Donner cut. And it's great because the thing is, the old cut is Clark Kent or, you know, Christopher Reeve sticking his hand in the fire. Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, and then she looks at it and says, you must be Superman. Yeah, whatever. Richard Donner's version is she takes out a gun and she's going to shoot him and she blows off a thing and he goes, oh, and she goes, see, it's just a starter pistol. But he basically confesses that he's Superman.
I swear I remember seeing it younger, possibly as a TV version or something. I'd know. It never existed.
It never existed until just a couple years ago.
Footage.
And it's so good. It's so dark and it's so much better of a Superman that, you know, it's on. I mean, they say Superman 2 is better than Superman 1 because all the criminals and all the stuff. It's such a good film.
See, this is proof, ladies and gentlemen, that actors don't necessarily always have to talk about themselves.
No.
We love this.
I can talk
industry.
About Smokey the Bandit.
We love
the I can
movies.
Talk about the Jolson story. I can talk about Pride of the Yankees, Ten Commandments. You know,
last thing on the toy for me was how different. And how many different directions did like the improv take and working with Richard Pryor? How was he working on being an actor and sticking to the script and those beats? Or was he also really, you know, did he change it up all the time? And what?
Gleason always changed it up. Richard changed it up 60, 70% of the time. For the first 2 weeks of shooting, whatever the script says, that's what I did. About the third week, I started ad-libbing.
I can
with
see
them.
When you get. Well, I can see it because I can see it in your eyes. You've got this very Cathedate the Canary look. You're like, I'm getting everybody, not just them, but everybody on set too. You're like, I'm gonna, and you. I can see you start to get empowered, and that's when.
Because Richard said to me, he said, "Listen, Scotty, you always do the lines, and that's great. But you know what? If I say something that's not exactly there, it's sort of like it, but it's not like it." And then you come and you say your exact line, it might not match. So let's just have a conversation. Let's just do it that way. Okay, great. And I mean, he would improv, Gleason would improv. And then I started and that was it, man. I went off. You know, once I started, then it really got to be fun because they knew I could handle bouncing. Just bounce. Just bounce. Whenever somebody shuts up, just bounce. Go for it.
Well, you're going to tell that you had a lot of fun. You can tell that you've had a lot of fun doing it.
4 months. I mean, you know, they say what's priceless? That was priceless.
I'm a fan of zombie movies. And You know, I never know on IMDb the timing because of things can be shelved or shot later or earlier, like
Raiders.
Kitco and Toy Kitco into you know, Christmas Story. All that that was pretty. When did Christmas Story come out there?
Came out Christmas of 83.
Oh, okay. And then Kitco came out 2 years after you shot
came
it.
Out in 84. Got spring it. Of 84. What a great release they gave us. They decided they were going to open it up at a test run in Mobile and Birmingham, Alabama. Okay. We got mediocre crowds. I mean, not any big deal, you know. But it's the why we didn't get anybody. They opened it up the same weekend as this movie you've never heard of and had nobody in it. It was called Splash. Daryl Hannah and Tom Hanks. And we were at the movie theater next to them. Now, you tell me anybody who stands there and looks at two movie theaters, oh, geez, you want to go see the one about the horse shit or you want to go see the one with Tom Hanks? We're going to Tom Hanks, okay?
The one about the horse shit.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
I didn't say it was.
So Raiders of the Living Dead. I want to know about that. Were
oh,
you?
Oh, my God.
Did they fund it with you?
Like, no.
Was that who? How did? Where
no,
did this come about?
No,
how did Raiders
great.
Of the Living Dead come about?
The guy who made Raiders of the Living Dead, his name is Sam Sherman, Independent International. It's a small company out of New Jersey. Knew me since I was 5 years old, known my dad since I was 2 or 3 years old. And when I became an actor, he's like, I'm going to find a movie and Scotty's going to be in it. Then, of course, I go union and blah, blah, and I do the movies. He bought like an hour and a half or something of zombie footage from somebody. That's all he bought was just zombie footage. He basically wrote this movie around having this zombie footage.
Great.
Coming up with the kid having a sort of a zest for electronics. And his grandfather has a VCR that needs fixing. So he gives it to the kid, to his grandson. I play with it. Next thing you know, I make a laser gun out of it that can shoot and kill zombies. I mean,
yeah,
it was wild, man. It was, oh my God, it's such a piece of garbage. But it was fun. It was, like,
well, that's
2 weeks.
Point of zombie movies.
Of
I hope
course,
that's why World War Z.
And we were at this, oh, we were at this 90 or 100-year-old prison that was closed. I mean, scared the shit out of me. I mean, it was just dark and frightening. And it was like, and you're walking around and there's guys in zombie costumes going, dude, I need a smoke, man. What's going on? I mean, it was the first time, though, that I got to go behind the camera. Sam Sherman let me shoot certain stuff that I found cool and interesting. You know, there was a tower there and they had a big, like, 2-foot opening, enough that you could get a camera lens through it. And below it was a walkway. And I'm going, wouldn't it be great to see me running like this? And you can shoot it from up on top, shoot it straight down. And then we could just go and, you know, just pan, go right to left and just pan following the zombies. He's like, that's great. Oh, yeah. You know, we did stuff like that. But it was, and the soundtrack was cool. It was funny. It was just that. Listen, I still got the poster. The poster's great. They've got me, like, defined. My arms are, like, ripped and torn up, and they just look great. And I'm like, that's not me, but it looks terrific. I think they spent as much on the posters and the soundtrack as they did the whole movie.
Great. Oh, God. After school, ABC After School specials. You know, everyone, that was funny as a kid. We had our different canvases.
Oh, yeah.
And there's the sitcom, and there's the you know, features, which is you start. That's so great that you just banged that right out there. Of course, you're on Nurse, but the after-school specials are a special little niche.
Well, yeah, because it's about the stuff we grew up on. It was every Wednesday on Channel 7 at 3 o'clock was the ABC after-school special, and you know,
it's always juicy. They're pregnant. They're on acid. They're what was your?
I did that funny fat kid. Which was about a kid who was taking too many diet pills and ended up like ODing, not ODing, but, you know, basically ended up in the hospital and took too many pills because he was trying to lose weight to impress the girls and whatever. And I did Just for Kicks, which was about a kid who wanted to be a football player. And he falls down, he hits his head, and he goes into this dream sequence where he becomes a field goal kicker. And he can kick 30 and 40-yard field goals. We shot it in Cincinnati. You know, at the school, and then we shot at Riverfront, so I got to kick field goals in Riverfront with Kevin Butler, who was the field goal kicker of the Chicago Bears, the Super Bowl team. So he was the special
guest. Now, where are you living at this time? We're talking like, you know, 87. Oh, Jump Street. So you're in Jersey?
I was still in New Jersey.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Jump Street, was that in Vancouver? Did you go to Vancouver for that? How fun was Vancouver?
Yeah, that was my 19th birthday I spent in Vancouver.
Oh, it's the legal drinking age in Canada, isn't
they
it?
They took me out. Johnny, Peter DeLuise, and Dustin Nigel took
Champagne
me out.
Champagne Charlie's.
Just got me blasted. You know, they got me toasted. But I wanted to say one more thing about the after school specials.
Yeah.
I didn't know it, but years later, a cousin of mine, I'm in Vegas at a video show, and he's like, Carmen Electra's here. I got to go meet Carmen Electra. And I'm like, I don't really know her. I don't know her. I never met her, but let's go say hi. I'll introduce myself. You'll get a picture. Everything is great. We walk over.
You're the bait.
I'll go get her. Okay. So we waited online, whatever. And we come up there and I said, you know, hi, it's a pleasure to meet you. This is who I am. She goes, oh my God, Scotty, how are you? And she starts talking. I'm like, was I asleep? What happened here? Whatever. And we start talking. She was in That Funny Fat Kid as a teenager. It was the first job she did because we shot it at her high school.
That's great.
And she was one
of
the extras.
That's so great.
So it's like now I see, I just saw her a couple of weeks ago and I'm like, hey girl, what's up? She's like, what's going on? You know, it's just that connection of things. But Jump Street, that was just, oh my God, they got me blasted. Oh, they got me just blasted.
Thing.
Oh my God. You know, to this day, I tell a story and people don't, I don't remember getting from the cab to my room. I remember getting in the cab. I remember the cab ride. That wasn't too good. But I don't remember getting from the cab to my room. Now, I do remember sitting in the little living room area, and I was watching Bill Cosby himself on the cable. I picked up my radio and I headed for the bedroom, and I started to hear him talking about the whole drinking thing, and you know what people do when they drink, and they talk to the toilet bowl. Oh, be nice, toilet bowl. Within 30 seconds, I was in the bathroom, and I was talking to the toilet bowl, listening to him on the television. Hysterical. And I ran into Peter once, and I've run into Johnny a couple times, and he's still just as nice as he was when we shot, you know.
Never met him. My mom loves me. She's like, you look like Johnny Depp. You could do like the pirate stuff. My mom's so supportive.
You could do
I love
the
her.
Stuff.
I love her. I didn't get to do my Jump Street with him. He was filming Crybaby.
Oh.
I had a Dustin Nguyen episode. Oh. And but Peter and then the DeLuises. I mean, because I grew up in Malibu in L.A. And it was more, even if you're not like working, you're going to school with these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you hear stories and around town and you see them. So the DeLuises, I don't know. I really do. I think that he's hysterical. I think Peter's wonderful. And he was so funny on the set. And he entertained mm-hmm. everybody off camera.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, we're waiting around to set up and he's doing Benny.
He's doing his thing, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, he had a good papa. You know, papa kind of helped. Papa had that personality as well.
Yeah.
You know, just, we lost Dom, you know, what, a year or two ago. And I mean, you know, great dude. I met him several times. He was really nice. And Peter's a good kid. And I met, Michael, I've talked to many times. Mm. So it's, connections of people you meet throughout the ages. We both kind of have done our own, we've done things. We never worked together, but you know what I mean? It's like, you know, you can meet somebody you haven't seen in 20 years.
Hey, didn't you do a bunch of commercials too?
Oh God.
How many?
Like, oh my God. I did, like, I did 130 on-camera commercials and I did like 140 voiceovers, radio spots.
When people ask me how to make money in this industry, I tell them, oh, you gotta do a bunch of commercials. Because you can. You could do pretty well depending on when, where they are, if they're national and all that stuff.
I wish I did those now and those then. Oh,
no kidding. God. When we're kids, man, they turned and burned us so fast on the set. What kind of stuff? What commercials?
Oh, Jesus. I did Honeycomb, HBO, Burger King. You can go on. Actually, you can
have
go
you found on YouTube? Have you found some of the
I
spots?
I found a commercial on YouTube. I hadn't seen it in 30 years. I kept telling people, I did a commercial with Julius Erving, with Dr. J. He was Dr. Chapstick back then.
Yes.
Okay. I got a bug up my tush one night and decided I was going to search it out on YouTube. And I kept seeing spot after spot where that the kid's in an arena and this and that and blah, blah, blah. Then in the middle of like 14 commercials, in the middle, it says, you know, Dr. Chapstick. All right, fine. Here we go again. I hit the button and bingo, it was my spot. I hadn't seen it in 30 years. Couldn't believe it. I've started emailing it to people. Yes. I'm like, I haven't seen it. You've never seen this. Look at the, you know, some people say, yeah, you work with Dr. J. Sure you did. No, I really, there it is, you know. Dr. Chapstick. Honey, let me see. Honey, Oreos, cookies, Reese's, peanut
butter. Wait,
Honeycombs,
butters. is there an animated character in Honeycombs?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm a big kid now with big things to do. So I start my day in a big way too. Ba-dump, ba-dump, and then it's Honeycomb, blah, blah, baloney. Cheetos. Have you had, I don't know if you know J.D. Roth.
J.D. Roth? Yeah.
Yeah, he's 3 Ball Productions. Yeah. Well, I know J.D. since we were 7 or 8 years old. And we did one, and we actually had to go into a studio and record the soundtrack. We had to lay it down first and then shot the commercial. And it was a bunch of kids coming off a school bus. And it's, it takes more than just our crunch to make it Cheetos. That's not enough to make it Cheetos. And then you got the little cheerleaders. It takes more than just our puff and all that other stuff, because it takes more cheese to make it Cheetos. Bam, bam, bam. And then they did this whole riff thing with the guitar. Hysterical. So that was me and JD. But no, I'm just tons.
Were you, so you're going to, what kind of school did you go to? Public, private, parochial?
Public school up until 9th grade. My freshman year in high school was when I really started hitting and doing the films, and my local high school couldn't handle it. So I went for 2 years to professional children's school in Manhattan, PCS. And, you know, I hung out there with Anthony Michael Hall, Malcolm Jamal Warner, Ricky Lake, Martha Plimpton, Ian Mitchell Smith, Paige Seaman, Mickey Barrett. I mean, just like...
Enough.
Oh, my
wow.
God.
Wow.
Rebecca Schaefer. You know, she was there. Jonathan Silverman. It went on and on. So I was there for my sophomore, junior year.
Did you
year.
Just say Rebecca Schaefer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was in our school.
You do that to me all the time. You drop stuff and you just kind of throw it away. And I'm like, what the fuck did you just say?
Yeah. It's Rebecca Schaefer, dude. I mean, it's...
See, the only thing better than you is when I was talking to you and your dad together. Because you both have the same great take and the same love and fun and perspective on it to have been, you know, and...
We understand it. When you go up the hill... And you'll know where I'm going. When you've been to the top of the hill and then you've been at the bottom of the valley, it's where you land. Do you land at the bottom? Do you land at the top? Or do you just settle in the middle where you're happy with who you are and you understand life? I've been at the top. I've been at the bottom. I'm in the middle. I'm happy with who I am.
And 32 minutes into the hour, we're that's the arc, man. That's great. That is a great, thank you. That helps me. Because I'm still thinking I haven't hit the top yet. And but I was talking to a friend. I was talking to him about,
but it's all it's
something
peaks
and
valleys.
I was working on. And I was like, if I hadn't had this opportunity, I couldn't have done this. And he goes, see, that's the thing about you, Keith. You said it, those opportunities. Like other people are like, oh yeah, well I did this, and I was like, oh no, I'm lucky for every goddamn day of work I ever had in the industry.
Listen, I am extremely blessed. I don't understand it. It's the question of life. Why? Why was I chosen to be pulled out of the group of kids I grew up with to not be the paper boy?
What was it earlier? Because you were doing it. What were you doing it before you were doing it? What were the type of things you were doing? Were you performing family and friends? Were you in school and performing?
I was a lunatic. I loved Mel Brooks. So, I mean, I was doing Blazing Saddles when I was 9 years old. My father didn't care. He was loved it. So I, you know, and then History of the World. I'm 11 years old. I'm doing Mel Brooks and Ron Carey and Gregory Hines and all of that. So I'm doing impressions and I'm doing Airplane. I always did that stuff. I did a couple school plays and all that kind of stuff. But my dad and I went to a film co-op society in New York. Older people watching films. I was by far the youngest member ever there. One of the guys, after a couple of years of knowing me, I started going when I was 5 and a half. Imagine that, going to 5 and a half, sitting for 4 and a half or 5 hours in a movie theater watching B-Westerns.
My mom was a usher, and I sat in the front row of The Sting, Clockwork Orange, and Exorcist.
Attaboy.
At like 4, 5, 6 years old.
Yeah. So it's sort of born into us. It was bred into us in its own strange way.
Yeah, and it certainly babysat by TV and, you know, and my grandfather, that was a thing of like, oh, he's, you know, on a, I loved it. He died. And they did a Thanksgiving thing where they started playing Addams Family on Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting around family, and all of a sudden I hear my grandfather's voice. What? He was from another room the TV was on. And I was like, oh, he's here for Thanksgiving. How nice. That was sweet. But the TV thing that I got in because of the kids that I saw on the Sesame Street Electric Company and Zoom. How did you guys get into the business?
One of the guys at the film club produced some commercials. Just came right out after a couple of years and said, listen, you're very, you know, boisterous. You're very friendly. You're a cute kid. Do you want to do a commercial? Well, what are we doing? Yoo-hoo chocolate drink. Going to fly to Miami Beach for a couple of days and do Yoo-hoo. Sure, let's go, man. I'm ready. You know, I was okay. I said, if it's okay with Dad, it's okay with me. Dad's like, hey, if you want to do it, let's go for it. Sure. So went down, did it. You know, hung out with Yogi Berra for a couple of days doing the Yoo-hoo commercials.
Right off the bat.
And you can find it.
You can find
it on YouTube. Unbelievable, man.
I hear you already talk freely about money and other friends of mine. Well, when Corey Haim, me and Corey were talking about some job and this, and he's like, you know, actors don't talk about money. I'm like, I just asked what your quote was on that. We're just in the same bit. I mean, I never had gotten that. You freely could talk about it. Do you remember what you got paid on your first job?
It was scale. What was it? 480 a day, 480 a day,
yeah,
something like
488
that.
488 or 444 or something.
Something like that, whatever it was. I mean, I was non-union. It was a Yoo-hoo commercial. I was non-union on my first gig, you know? So whatever they paid, the minimum, whatever, and they sent me down to Miami, and okay, fine. And then he said, you're great. I'm going to introduce you to casting director in New York, Joanna Prosciutto. Met with her. Mm. She introduced me to a couple of agents, and then I just sort of took off from there.
Who were your first kid agents?
I was with one, Marion Adler. She was with Sanford Lee beginning out, and then she went someplace else for a short time. And I say this without no ego. I was working so much, making her so much money, she said, this is ridiculous, and opened up her own place. I mean, basically, I mean, it was sort of a joke between us. She said, Scotty, you've made me so much money that you pay the rent here. That's just it's like Out of Life with Mikey, with Michael J. Fox, where the one kid is the serial kid paying the rent. When you go out, when you do 24 commercials in 35 days, you shoot 24 spots, you're paying the rent.
No, you building the building.
I mean, it was hysterical.
Wow.
It got to the point where they actually had auditions that they would send out to the agents. They would fax over the thing. And they'd say, you know, what are they looking for? And it would say, looking for a Scott Schwartz type.
I got one time, we're looking for a young Keith Mitchell. My stage name before like 86 or so. I heard that once. I was like, that's great.
I went on my own audition. I didn't book the job. I still don't understand that, but okay.
I remember TV 101. God damn it. Another one I fucking didn't get.
Listen.
No. I'm not bitter. I remember going up for these and being that's a cool show. I saw it in the TV Guide, like, ad of the coming shows, and then I got the call to go up for it, and I'm like, I want to be on the show.
You're not bitter. I'm bitter. I'm going to tell you the story. I get the show. I do the pilot. There's 8 or 9 kids on the show.
I know.
Okay. You had Terry Polo and you had Matt LeBlanc. Okay. Those were the two kind of featured people, and then everybody else was kind of fringe. I'm the only one making any money. I'm the only one that did any real work before that point.
See, well, ladies and gentlemen, in the listening audience, back in the day, there used to be a thing called precedence, and there used to be a thing called a quote. And you would, quote, build your quote. And you'd work over time, and you would start to get little raises, and then you really couldn't work for anything less than that. And you had a value that had been established, a Q rating, a television awareness. You had this value, and that value would always build and increase slowly and steady and modestly. Even at best, Kirk Cameron was making $50,000 a week on Growing Pains.
Mm-hmm.
We know that like other actors today make far more than that. And even the child actors make far more than that to start. Right now, standards and practices at Fox would give you maybe $13,500.
Yeah.
You know, to start, unless you come, even with precedence, that's the thing, even with the quote, today, the studios have crushed the nuts of SAG, AFTRA, and everybody, this, you know, all that other stuff, studios, production companies, and they're like, well, no, this is what it pays.
Mm-hmm.
And you take the worker, you leave it. There's 45,000 LA SAG people alone that will
there's a good
take
friend
your
of mine
job right now.
Who was in a $200 million film, budgeted what? Film. Okay,
he's how many of those are made?
There's several, but okay. He's in it. And the director said, I know that your quote is this, but you're going to work for scale plus 10. If you want to do this movie, it's scale plus 10. If not, you know what? There's another 40 people lined up behind you that want to work.
You know, no if choice. It's Soderbergh and it's traffic and you're like, you know, Steve, I've done like three pictures with you. And
well, let's see.
This could be your Oscar. I'll do it for scale or whatever. Right. But this is
the director,
rape.
I wouldn't say is probably as good as that. But the production was bigger than traffic. It was enormous.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They've had three sequels since. Anyway, so TV 101. I do the pilot and I'm getting paid almost triple scale. Scale at the time was like $1,300 a mm-hmm. week, and I was getting $3,500 a week. I had done all this work. Okay, fine. We're waiting. Finally, I see it in Variety. It got picked up. I'm like, this is awesome. Because my pickup was, I think, at like $4,000 a show. You know, great. 20 episodes, $80,000. I'm a happy guy. This is awesome.
Was that
awesome.
Hour 8 days, or was that like a, was that a half hour show? What was the?
No, it was a half hour show.
It was a half hour show.
Yeah. And, a couple days later, the producers called me into to the office down at Sony, and they like, listen, you know, we want to thank you, blah, blah, blah. This is the situation. We have 9 kids. There's just too many people. We can't feature all these people on the show. Therefore, we had to make some cuts. You're the only one making any money. You're gone. We're not picking up. Right. We're not picking you up for the show.
Right. Law of economics, man.
Law of economics. I'm like, are you serious? Come on. You got to be kidding.
Fuck. Now, you blew my mind when I saw you a couple years ago, because my mom was a studio fence hopper, and she heard about this gig, Kangaroos in the Kitchen, coming up, and she goes, you know, we couldn't get you. We submitted. You didn't get it. She's telling me. She's like, we're going to crash it. You just don't do that, and I don't recommend it to any actors. Don't crash auditions. You know, there's a way in, and, you know, it takes a lot of work and perseverance, and when you do get your chance, you better be fucking on.
Mm-hmm.
You better be fucking ready and you better be fucking prepared when you do get your chance. But it takes a while to do it, or could be overnight. 20 years of work, and then it could be overnight.
Realistically, we wake up and get out of bed and we're ready. If you're not ready at that
thing,
point.
I literally roll out of bed and be ready.
Exactly.
And when you're doing 8 shows a week in theater and you're between those
Broadway.
2 shows on Saturday,
absolutely.
And you try to fucking eat something and get some sleep before the next show, 5 minutes to curtain, you literally do a roll out of bed and get ready. What kind of theater?
I did Frankenstein on Broadway, 1980.
When was that, 80?
Yeah. January 4th, 81, we opened and closed. We had 29 previews and opened and closed.
Oh, no.
There was no sleep. I was 12 years old. Yeah, I didn't need sleep. I could go 20 hours a day. I was the Energizer bunny.
I ate sugar. I went to craft service and would have 2 chocolate glazed donuts and start to have a bagel and cream cheese. And I'd still be running around the set. Like, you know,
have you ever shot in New York?
Yeah.
There's nothing like shooting something in New York, because at 3 o'clock in the morning, if you get hungry, something's open to go get something. It's fantastic. It doesn't matter what it, you get a hot dog, you can get a slice of pizza, donuts, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Shooting in New York is the absolute ultimate. And doing Broadway? Oh, my God, wow. Broadway.
What theater were you guys in?
The Palace.
We just saw Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, at the Palace.
That's the new Palace. They redid everything.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But it was great because you got everything within a block. It didn't make any difference. After the show, all right, fine. You're looking at your watch. 10:30, 10:45. Yeah, let's go out to dinner. You go out to dinner 11 o'clock at night and have a really good
meal.
But
you can't, after a show, you cannot come down that easy. I mean, you can't, you know, an hour later go to bed. That's ridiculous. 12 years old or not.
Funny, there was a 2-act play, but the first scene in the 2nd act, I get killed. The monster kills me. So from that point till the end
curtain.
Of the show, I'm dead. I'm sitting in my dressing room playing video games, and I used to go underneath the theater. They had a runway that went underneath the seats to the back of the house. And I would just go to the back of the house and stand there and watch the end of the show, you know, watch most of the end of the show. Then I'd come back and go out for my curtain call, you know. I'd go up to the mezzanine and go sit with my parents sometimes.
It's so cool. I'm also jealous of being on Broadway. You bastard. I didn't even know that. I didn't even know you were on Broadway.
Yeah.
And 49 previews. One night.
29 previews opening night.
Oh, man.
We had John Glover as Dr. Frankenstein's friend.
Yeah.
David Dukes, not the politician, the actor David Dukes playing Dr. Frankenstein. Diane Wiest played Elizabeth. John Carradine played the blind man. We're talking Papa John Carradine, he played the blind man. Victor Gialanella was our writer. He went on to do the Academy Awards, and he's done General Hospital, all this other stuff. Tom Moore was the director who had done Night Mother. He won like seven Tonys. I mean, it was amazing. But they got bad reviews, and the producers made too much money, and they said, I forget it, just close the shit. And that was it.
This goes. Well, don't feel so bad. You know, it happens to everybody. And that was the thing I had a saying when we were a kid. I've been fired off of more jobs than most people have gotten. And so jumped a studio lot to get one.
Now, what? If I'm right, and you're going to confirm this or not, and we're doing this on the air, and we're going to have
okay.
Not in front of the kids.
Not in front of the kids. Why does that ring a frickin' bell? Oh my God. Who was the female lead on that?
You mean Joyce Randolph and Donna Meachie?
Yeah. No. It was called Kangaroos in the Kitchen and then Not in Front of the Kids. Remember? No? Yeah, no, Donna Meachie. And did Nino Pelucci do it? Nino Pelucci.
Okay.
Right? Did he wind up doing it?
I don't
know. Because Donna Meachie was off book at the table.
See, now, didn't they hire you? And then
I was at the table read.
Yep.
And there's a crying scene.
Yep.
And I'm just, they're like, you know, the typical speech before the table read. All right, no acting, just read. We'll be out of here in 38 minutes. Great reading, you know, about 30% into it. Great. Donna Meachie was off book. And you said that earlier. You went through it mm-hmm. for Christmas Story and you burned it through. That's a different level. Mm-hmm. And that for, I think I took it a bit for granted because my grandpa and work, 5 years old, and I'm starting doing one sets, and then this, commercials to episodic. To
but you were like 8 or 9 at this time, I think. It was 84.
Oh, I'm 14.
Oh, you were 14?
Yeah, I'm 14. And we hopped the studio lot to get the audition. So we do it's KTTV, KTLA. We jump the lot, we go, oh yeah, just sign in. And do read, got it. Do the table read. Mort Lockman fires me. And Mort, he said, as good actor is 100% all the time. And I've taken that quote.
You're going to love this story.
I know you are, because you fucking told me and it blew my mind and it made perfect sense of what went down. But he was right. A good actor is 100% all the time. And from now on, at every table read, it's like, no, I'm going to do this. You know, I'm going to talk to these people and do this part. There's no walking through it. I'm so pissed to be fired off of that. And I'm a kid. I'm 14 years old. To take that kind of firing is tough.
The listeners have absolutely no idea, realistically, what the setup to this is. I came out to read screen tests for Not in Front of the Kids. Myself and another girl. I couldn't tell you her name to save my life. And Mort Lockman loved me. There were 8 people that I needed to pass. Or 9 people I needed to pass. 8 of them loved me. The guy who didn't like me was the head of programming for NBC. He didn't like me. I came out twice to LA from New York. They flew me out. Mort Lockman's like, it's your job. We love you. We got to convince this guy. Blah, blah, blah. Finally, it was a week before shooting. And they're like, Mort's like, we're getting you this job. You don't understand. I love you. You're going to be great. We have to convince this guy. Couldn't convince the guy to do it. Next thing I know, I get a call from Brandon Tartikoff at home. And Brandon's like, is this Scott Schwartz? I said, yeah. Brandon Tartikoff here. It's a nice pleasure. You have a big fan. Mort Lockman just loves your work. He says you have to be on this show. Will you come back to LA tomorrow, please? Well, you don't say no to the guy that's the head of the network. So the next night, my dad and I flew. We took the red eye back to LA for the third trip. That night, Brandon's mother, or I think it was his mother or father. I think it was mother, had a heart attack. He was gone. So now I don't get to see Brandon, but I see the same 9 people sitting in the room. And this is a Tuesday or Wednesday? I think it was Wednesday. Friday is the day Thursday, I think they hired you. And you did the table reading on Friday. And I got a call at 5 o'clock Friday night. from Mort Lachman. Scotty, we hired a kid. We fired him already. We don't know what we're... Nobody knows what we're doing here. Will you come back out? And my father said, listen, three trips is enough. Fax the contract. We'll be on a plane tomorrow. We'll do the job. That plain and simple. They could not convince the guy who's the head of programming for NBC to do this. He said, listen, if you want to hire Scott, there's no problem. I got a slot open at 2:30 on Saturdays. Don't worry about it. He literally would not even consider... No, forget it. They hired
Mino.
Yeah.
It was Punky Brewster's brother.
Yeah. And then it was a disaster. I think they showed the pilot on Saturday morning one day, and then that it gone. I think they shot six episodes, and that was the end of it.
I don't remember. They fired off commercials. Okay. Yeah, let's go to early lunch. That's great. Going home. Okay.
Going home. Well. And then they're calling me. And this is hysterical that the two people involved in the story are here.
Well, Utah, I didn't know all the other politics of this and that, and that he wouldn't. He was like, no, it's not on my network. NBC. I had a real. Was that NBC?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That wasn't the first time for me to be. We have a caller, which is so fucking awesome.
Cool.
But the NBC, I never got past network at NBC. I did two shows, two series for CBS, one for ABC, and I never got to NBC. Caller, how are you? Thanks for calling. What's your question for Scott Schwartz? Who is this? What's your social security number, your PIN, and your bank account number?
Well, I would never ask Scott Schwartz that. I might ask you because, you know, you were in Goonies.
I wasn't in Goonies.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just teasing. No, long-time listener, second-time caller, and Scott Schwartz, my question for you.
Yes, sir.
Do you ever think in our lifetime we will have a movie with the two greatest icons of you know, movie icon of just personality TV star in Jackie Gleason and comedic icon with Richard Pryor? I mean, that is a movie that is, in my humble opinion, an integral for being a...
They are two incredible superstars.
Yes, I would say no for this reason. You've got Gleason, who had 65 years of experience or 50 years of experience, and you've got Pryor, who is the comedian's comedian, you know, the icon. And they put them together.
And I'm His wife and I are acquaintances, and she, in her own right, is funnier than most comics today.
Whose wife?
You talking about Jennifer?
Yeah, Jennifer.
I love her to death. She's awesome. Pryor's Planet. Pryor's Planet.com. That's their website for the doggies and the kitty cats and save the animals, and I love that. I'm plugging Pryor's Planet here. I love
it. Plug it away. That's awesome. Thank you for that comment, I guess. I mean,
it's an interesting question because it worked because it really wasn't being done, you know, to comedians. They're trying to do it now. They're trying to have people mix and match. Some work, some don't work. Eddie Murphy with, what's his name? Stein Tower Heist.
Yeah, okay. It was,
you know,
actually Eddie Murphy was one of the best things in Tower Heist.
Mm-hmm.
He really was.
But they're trying to mix and match people to see their personalities.
Yeah, but they're all at about a 7. Nobody's this kind of 10 like, we have another caller. Nobody's at the 10, 11, 12 groundbreakers that both of them were.
Give me icons.
Who invented sitcoms and who broke, you know, so many color lines.
Barriers.
And language barriers and concept barriers. I mean, only if George Carlin came and did, you know, something with Lucy, maybe we're close. We have another caller. How are you? Thanks for calling the call sheet.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
This is O.W. calling back.
O.W., our old good friend. How are you?
You didn't have a screener. I was waiting to talk to somebody. I didn't know I'd get right through. Apparently, I've got like a hotline here.
How are you and your brother? You guys okay?
We're doing okay. He's going out and getting a pizza. We're just going to hang out tonight. So I was listening to the show. Big Scott Schwartz fan. Keith, I want to say, I don't remember you in the Goonies.
He wasn't in the Goonies. How drunk was the previous caller, really?
I was smoking a fatty.
He was like on a freeway on the cell phone.
That freaked me out. I thought I was crazy. Anyway, the toy. You can't pitch a movie like that today. You can't pitch a movie about a dad getting his kid a black man for Christmas.
No, they talked about doing a reversed one with a black kid with a white guy. They've talked about it, but they never did it.
A little white man's burden for Lemon Patrol to his white man's burden.
Yeah.
They did a series after All in the Family with a black family that moved into the same house. And the dad was a bigot.
Different time, different era. You couldn't do All in the Family
we'll flip
today.
It. Yeah, no.
You can't do All in the
She's
Family.
She's holding the whip.
Exactly.
Yeah, no.
You can't do Blazing Saddles and you can't do the toy today.
Blazing Saddles.
If you could do the toy today, who would you cast? Who would be in the movie?
Oh my God.
Good question.
Probably like Chris Rock would have to be the Richard Pryor role.
I was thinking Jamie Foxx the drama chops. But
then it's like the old Southern, but it's the old Southern big heavy set guy. What actors do we have that are around that are like that? You know, Tom Hanks can only do so many different roles, okay?
Eddie Murphy's comeback.
He's terrific.
Eddie Murphy.
Just saying.
Yeah, no, that's great. Eddie Murphy.
I think he's too old, though. Although, if he played the father of the black kid who's trying to hire the white guy, now that would be funny.
Wow. Now, he has, apparently, there's rumor that he's going to be in this twin sequel I read about.
Yeah, that's
Arnold
what I heard.
Schwarzenegger.
I'm going to puke.
He's the missing brother. He's one of the other brothers through the thing that they did that they've somehow lost. Somehow they came out with a black brother. Now, if you watch Twins, the original, all seven guys are white. So I'm trying to figure out how they're coming up with this. Was there a Jamaican thing in here? I don't know.
That was my only question. I have nothing else.
Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you, OW.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Have a good night. Another caller we have. Am I supposed to push something? No. Okay. Thank you so much for calling in. The toy. I couldn't imagine them remaking it. They would cast a girl as the
probably
daughter to really flip it up. And thank you, caller. How are you from the 254?
Yeah, sorry about that. My AT&T just doesn't love me. Scott was answering my question about Pryor and Gleason.
Thank you for calling back. AT&T doesn't really love anybody, so you're not alone there.
AT&T loves AT&T.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know who you would have as the old Southern father. You know, it's tough. You know, Clooney can only do so many roles, you know, and Tom Hanks can only do so many roles.
Nick Nolte.
Ooh.
Which movie?
Comedic style Nick Nolte? I don't know.
Teachers.
Did you watch Luck?
No.
Okay, I watched Luck. That's, you know. He's not the comedic guy.
We have a minute to go with Scott Schwartz, which is a painfully shy amount of time.
I thought we were going to have more time, man. I'd sit there for another hour.
I didn't know. Toy remake is a great idea. Were they talking about that for real?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yes?
Scott Schwartz, would you do the I don't want to buy, sell anything, you know, monologue from...
Say anything?
Say anything, please.
I'll do it. I don't want to buy anything that's bought, processed, or sold. I don't want to sell anything that's processed or bought or transported to be sold. I just want to kick back and be with your daughter.
That sounds good to me.
I auditioned for that, which is absurd. If sometimes you're out of the age range, and I auditioned for like 16 Candles, and I was way too young. I auditioned for Say Anything. I was way too young.
See, now we
young.
Have a friend of mine.
Thanks
my friend
for
Terry from my friend Terry from Missouri. Yeah. She said, how about John Goodman? For a remake.
Oh.
How about John Goodman? Thank you, Terry. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Good call. We have 30 seconds left. Anything you want to say? What's the memorabilia site? What website?
It's sports and movieandsports.com. You made me think of it. Movieandsports.com, and our shop is baseball card and movie collectibles. We're in Woodland Hills on Ventura Boulevard.
And you specialize in getting authenticated autographs, don't you?
We have thousands of autographs. We have cards. We have 3,000 square feet of retail space. And we have a ton of stuff. So
thanks for everybody for listening. I'm Keith Coogan. This was Scott Schwartz.
God bless everybody.